rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick heads up, Senator Gordon Smith of Oregon. This is interesting. I live here in Oregon, so it's interesting as a local story, but it's also a very important national story. There is a piece of legislation that is bottled up right now because a hold was put on it that would essentially kill off internet neutrality. And Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the Democrat, put the hold on it, which is the equivalent of a filibuster. He's essentially filibustering this bill. And he did it this summer. In fact, he said, and I quote, "Without a clear policy preserving the neutrality of the internet and without tough sanctions against those who would discriminate, the internet will be forever changed for the worse." That's what he said back on June 28th when he announced that he was putting a hold on the legislation. He was filibustering this internet, or this telecommunications reconfiguration bill, or whatever it's called. Well, now the Republican senator from Oregon, Gordon Smith, comes before, this is according to Broadcasting and Cable Magazine, speaking before a group of media executives yesterday. So he's standing in front of a bunch of fat cats in the telecommunications industry, and he says, "We need your help. We need 60 votes." And what do you want to bet the implicit message behind that was either, and by the way, my campaign could use a few million bucks, or, oh, and by the way, thank you so much for your campaign contributions. So here we have the Republican Gordon Smith saying, internet neutrality, we don't need no stinking internet neutrality. In fact, here's exactly what he said. He said, if you say right up front you can't charge this or you can't discriminate as to customers who bring volume, then you take a tremendous incentive away from investment. Oh, gee. Internet neutrality is a big deal because the internet right now is the last medium in the United States where you can actually get a truly wide range of opinion, and the playing field is level. Every website loads at the same speed. If I go to, 911truth.org or rents.com or, if knightstemplar.com, it's going to load just as quickly as if I go to disney.com. And the reason for that is because right now it is against the law because the web is considered part of the commons. It was created by the government. It is considered part of the commons. It is against the law for telecommunications corporations to say, if you want your web page to load really fast, you have to pay us an extra $100,000 a month. Otherwise, your web page is going to take 5 seconds to load because you're going to be put in the slow speed lane. And that's what they want to do. They want to Disney-fy the web. This is about the internet coming under the same pressures that local communities are coming under from Walmart. This is about great big corporations coming in and saying, hey, our website is more important than your website. It's easier to get to. It's more visible. It loads faster. And it's wrong. So, anyhow, just a heads up, Ron Wyden has been filibustering this thing and since June, and good on him for it. And now Gordon Smith and other Republicans as well, but Smith apparently leading the charge to do away with network neutrality, trying to break Ron Wyden's filibuster. You may make your opinions known to your senators and just say, the very simple way to say it is, please stand with Ron Wyden in blocking efforts to destroy network neutrality on the web. Please stand with Ron Wyden and support Ron Wyden. Vote with Senator Ron Wyden. And you can call your senators toll-free, 888-355-3588, 888-355-3588. The headline that greeted me this morning when I picked up the local paper, this from Wire Reports, a photograph, great big photograph, about a foot square, almost, well, maybe 9 inches square. Iraqi family members mourn as they arrive at a hospital morgue to retrieve the body of a relative Wednesday in Baghdad, and you see these two men, two grown men, and two little boys just sobbing. Sobbing. And the headline, "Nearly 100 die in Baghdad in wave of torture bombs, torture, comma, bombs. In the story from Wire reports, on a violent day, even by standards in Baghdad, nearly 100 people were killed or found dead in the Iraqi capital, authorities said Wednesday. 65 bullet-riddled corpses, all bearing signs of torture, some of them beheaded, were found dumped in streets throughout the city since Tuesday night, said Brigadier General Abdullah Mahmoud of the Interior Ministry. Now, while Prime Minister, this all happened while Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is in Iran. For the first time in 300 years, the leader of Iraq got a red carpet reception in Iran. Why? Because George W. Bush wanted more political power. Because Dick Cheney wanted oil.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and because George W. Bush thought, hey, I can make some political hay with this, as he, you know, when it was time to write the obligatory autobiography. I mean, Jack Kennedy actually wrote Profiles in Courage. That wasn't his autobiography, but he actually wrote it. He was in a hospital bed, which wasn't the reason, George W. Bush, he couldn't write. In college, this guy was probably hiring people to write his term papers and his papers and take tests for him. That was very common, frankly, back in the 50s and 60s. I certainly knew, in fact, a friend of mine at Michigan State University started a business. Brad started this company to sell term papers and to take tests for people. He got, you know, ultimately they figured out a way to make it illegal, and they busted him, and they started busting his clients. But you know, that was in, what, 68 it must have been. But Bush was in college before that, probably hiring people to take it. So anyhow, he did the same thing with his autobiography. They hired a guy to write his autobiography for him, Mickey Herskowitz. His autobiography, it's in print right now. It's called A Charge to Keep. The Noble Life of George W. Bush. Yeah. And Mickey Herskowitz wrote the first draft, and it wasn't suck up enough for the Bush family, although they liked him. I mean, Mickey was an old friend of the Bush family, journalist from Texas. So they took his first draft, and they said, okay, thanks a lot. They paid him off, and then they gave it to another writer, another ghostwriter, and said, gussy this thing up. And Mickey Herskowitz then later had a conversation with the press in which he just laid it out, as Cindy Sheehan testified before John Conyers' commission looking into, you know, the crimes of Bush with regard to the war in Iraq.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
So there you go. That's probably part that Mickey Herskowitz had put in the book. That's probably why they decided to get another writer. Mickey, we really don't want this in the book, Charge to Keep, so we'll replace that. Over in our chat room, which you can get to, by the way, by going to tomhartman.com, Clench notes, the source went on to say that the victims were tortured in ingenious and ugly ways, such as by yanking out their spinal cords, breaking their leg bones, and twisting them around to face backwards, beating their heads with steel hammers until they were misshapen, or stuffing gum up their noses and mouths, suffocating them. I mean, this is the insanity that is going on in Baghdad. Now, oddly enough, there wasn't much of this going on before one particular event happened. We weren't hearing about gangland-style executions. We weren't hearing about death squads until the United States appointed to be its ambassador to Iraq, Death Squad John Negroponte, the guy who, when we sent him down to Honduras to be the ambassador, and our foreign aid to the dictator down there went from $3 million a year to $77 million a year, all of a sudden death squads started springing up. And what brought it to the attention of the American people is they killed a few American priests and nuns, but they killed a whole lot of local folks down there in El Salvador and Honduras and Nicaragua. And so Death Squad John goes over to Iraq, and within weeks, all of a sudden, death squads are appearing and bodies are showing up. This is a sad, sad, sick situation that George W. Bush created so that he could get political capital, and Dick Cheney so that he and his friends could make some money, and the neocons promoted so that they could say, see, we can create a world that works. Yeah. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I got news of the very best kind about trouble. I'm better falling behind about people that used to be blind till they open up their eyes to see. It's new when they begin to ask why they're poor, until the day that they die they're tired of flying the sky and they want some security. And it's news, news, ain't that news, ain't that something to see. News, news, to talk about the news, it's mighty good news to me.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, it's the news that they want to control. Frankly, the last commons in the United States is the Internet. The last news commons used to be, you know, radio and TV stations, in order to keep their licenses, had to have real news on the air in order to perform, you know, the public service of paying back for the airwaves. Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton privatized the airwaves. Now Gordon Smith and other Republicans want to privatize the Internet. What are we going to be left with? Newspapers were privatized long ago. Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act back in 1981, 82, so newspapers started consolidating like crazy. What are we going to be left with? Three companies owning everything we hear, everything we know, everything we read, every place we can go. And in the midst of this, an insane occupation of Iraq, a country melting down, All for political gain for the Republicans. And they're actually, I mean, they're using this. Bush is today in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, this is the other side of it. Here's the other half, the juxtaposition. There's really three halves to this thing this morning here, this story. The other half, John Harwood reporting on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, Bush gets a lift from emphasis on terror in Iraq. In other words, the more Bush can terrify us, the more his opinion ratings go up. That's my interpretation. Here's what John Harwood wrote. He said, President Bush's efforts to explain and win support for his policies on Iraq and terrorism appear to be paying some initial dividends as midterm congressional campaigns heat up. A new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll shows that Mr. Bush's overall approval ratings, as well as his marks on handling Iraq, rose modestly after a series of speeches imploring Americans to remain patient despite repeated setbacks in Iraq. He's gone from 38% in June up to 42% in terms of his approval ratings. So it's going to be all war all the time. I mean, this is just absolutely tragic. The leader of Iraq's biggest Sunni Arab group demanded Wednesday that the beleaguered Shiite-led government take steps to disarm militias. This from the Associated Press, after police said the bodies of 65 tortured men were dumped in and around Baghdad. On a violent day, even by the standards of Baghdad, car bombs, mortars, and other attacks also killed at least 39 people and wounded others. Two U.S. soldiers also were killed, one in enemy action in restive Anbar province on Monday and the other in a roadside bombing south of Baghdad on Tuesday, the U.S. military command said. I mean, it's just amazing. In fact, let's just take a look at the larger picture of what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire.
In addition to the stories that I've just shared with you, these are the following security and other developments in Iraq reported on Thursday as of 07:30 Greenwich Mean Time. Dateline Baghdad, 9 people were killed and 26 wounded when a car bomb went off near a police patrol in central Baghdad. You know, every one of these people has a family. In Mosul, 4 people were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a U.S. patrol in that northern city. In Baghdad, a person was killed and 13 wounded when a car bomb went off near a photography shop in northeastern Baghdad. In Dinawaya, 10 people were wounded and 1 killed in clashes between protesters and guards at the governorate building in that city. Hospital source said the protesters were demonstrating against U.S. forces storming of an office of followers of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. In Baghdad, gunmen killed Muthana Ali Hussein, a traffic police colonel, in the Dora district. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army said it had killed 3 insurgents and arrested 14 in the last 24 hours in different cities in Iraq. And in Baghdad, in other developments, the trial of Saddam Hussein and 6 co-accused for the killing of tens of thousands of Iraqi Kurds in 1988 resumed with more witnesses giving testimony. And you go back to 2002. I mean, this is what was predicted. September 30, 2002, CNN. This is before we invaded. In fact, this was before the elections of 2002, because you'll recall whipping up the war hysteria in August and September and October led to the elections in November of more Republicans. At least that's the official story. In 2002, the last time there were midterm elections, they whipped up war frenzy. This from CNN, September 30, 2002. U.S. Representatives David Bonnier, Michigan, and Jim McDermott, Washington, talked to CNN's Paula Zahn Monday. McDermott, well, the inspectors are meeting with the Iraqis today in Vienna, and they are about to come back to Iraq, and the president says it's a ploy. I would suggest that he and Trent Lott take a trip over there and have a look and see if they are really honestly allowing inspections. If you want peace, you got to let these inspections go forward. As long as they continue to try and agitate and derail it, it's simply not good for the American people or the Iraqi people. Jim McDermott, a man ahead of his time. Good on you, Jim McDermott. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, supported by our listeners, by supporting our sponsors. Support the sponsors that you hear on your local affiliate, please, and let them know that you heard the program. And also, the sponsors for our national program, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, 1-800-425-2532. I am powered by Sacred Grounds right now, drinking a cup of their Peruvian French roast, certified organic and fair trade coffee, as are all of their coffees. And man, this stuff is good. You got to check out the Peruvian French roast. It's good stuff. 800-425-2532. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS. And apologies for that last break went 1 minute long, and I'm not sure why. And it wasn't us just trying to slip in an ad about my book, because it's supposed to be in the normal rotation. So to our affiliates and listeners, apparently we goofed in the log, and we'll fix that. But back to the issues at hand. We have Jack Murtha now coming out, and just, you know, he's over it. Here's a guy, 37 years in the Marine Corps, one of the leading, the fact that he's a Democrat, irrelevant, one of the leading advocates of the military, one of the best friends of the military for years and years and years in the United States House of Representatives, Jack Murtha.
I'm introducing a resolution today asking for a resignation of Secretary Don Rumsfeld.
Thanks.
To emphatically state that the global war on terror will last for years, yet fail to even acknowledge, let alone take steps to address the Army's readiness, equipment, and personnel shortfalls is short-sighted at best. At worst, it's unconscionable, because the future security and deterrent power of the United States is dangerously at risk.
Dangerously at risk. In the meantime, Kevin Drum writing in the Washington Monthly, and well, actually there's several of these things. Stephanie Heinen said in the Daily Press, Army Brigadier General Mark Scheid, an early planner of the war, tells about challenges of invasion and rebuilding. Months before the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld forbade military strategists, forbade military strategists from developing plans for securing a post-war Iraq, the retiring commander of the Army Transportation Corps said Thursday, this last week. In fact, said Brigadier General Mark Scheid, Rumsfeld said he would, quote, fire the next person, end quote, who talked about the need for a post-war plan. You see, democracy is messy. Things happen. In fact, Rumsfeld did replace General Eric Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, in 2003 after Shinseki told Congress that hundreds of thousands of troops would be needed to secure post-war Iraq. Scheid, who is also the commander of Fort Eustis in Newport News, made his comments in an interview with the Daily Press. This is the local paper. He retires in about 3 weeks. He said he didn't go as far as calling for Rumsfeld to resign. He's listened to other retired generals who have done so. He says, everybody has a right to their opinion, but what good did it do? Sounds like this is a guy who doesn't want to burn all of his bridges. Well, who knows? I mean, this amazing. This is amazing. And why is that not a national story? Why is CBS and ABC and NBC not reporting that? Why is it just in the local paper in Newport News, Virginia? And again, we go back to 2002, when this was being used, the last midterm election, 4 years ago, the last midterm elections, and Karl Rove was whipping up hysteria in the Republican ranks, among Americans, frankly, particularly reaching out to swing voters and security moms and Democrats who want to be strong in defense and saying, Be very afraid. Paula Zahn, Representative McDermott, I'm going to start with, this is in 2002, September 30, 2002. Representative McDermott, I'm going to start with you. You accused the president of potentially misleading the American people down the road. What evidence do you have that he would do such a thing? This was 4 years ago. McDermott. Well, the inspectors are meeting with the Iraqis today in Vienna, and they are about to come back to Iraq, and the president says it's a ploy. I would suggest that he and Mr. Malott make a trip over here and have a look. Now, this is McDermott was in Iraq as he was talking to her on satellite. I would suggest that he and Mr. Malott make a trip over here and have a look and see if they are really honestly allowing inspections. If you want peace, then you've got to let these inspections go forward. As long as they continue to try and agitate and derail it, that's simply not good for the American people or the Iraqi people. Paul Azad. Well, let me ask you this, sir. The Iraqi vice president over the weekend made it very clear that he's not going to accept any new resolutions. He will only go with the old resolutions, which means he would be barred from going into 8 presidential sites. Isn't that a problem for you? McDermott, why don't we wait until Hans Blix meets with them and comes over here and begins the inspection? I trust Mr. Blix to be a fair and impartial and professional inspector. And if it's 60 days, he comes back to the United States and says, well, they won't let me into this place. They wouldn't let me into that place. That's a new circumstance. At that point, we'll make another decision. Paula Zahn, CNN. Still pushing the Rove position. But Representative Bonnier, don't you already know that inspectors are not going to be allowed into these places? When the Iraqi vice president says no new rules, let's go back to the old ones, and the old ones prohibited the inspectors from going into those 8 very sites? Bonnier, David Bonnier from Michigan, God bless him. Another man who is willing to stand up and speak the truth. Congressman David Bonnier from Michigan. He says, well, no, we don't know that, Paula. See, Paula just repeating the Rove talking points. He says, well, we have heard repeatedly on our trip from, and again, this is September 30th, 2002, before the midterm elections and, what, 5 months before the invasion? The invasion was March 20th, 2003. He says, well, no, we don't know that, but what we have heard repeatedly on our trip from leaders of the government of Iraq, the foreign minister, the deputy prime minister, Mr. Aziz, is that they will have the ability to go wherever they want to go, unrestricted, unconditional, unfettered opportunities to do that. In other words, Paula, why are you throwing out these Karl Rove talking points when they're not even the truth? Those are my words, not Bonnier's. Bonnier was the diplomat. He says, and today, the meeting in Vienna is to set the rules and regulations on which that will take place. And so we ought to let that happen, rather than jumping to the conclusion that it won't happen, dooming it before it ever happens, and thus laying the pretext or a path to war. You get this? In September of 2002, David Bonnier, the congressman from Michigan, is still assuming that maybe George Bush is operating in good faith. What he didn't know, and we know now from the Downing Street minutes and the testimony of a whole wide range of people, including Paul O'Neill, Secretary of Treasury, so the very first meeting that they had in the White House, first topic of discussion, this was in January 2001, what, 9 months before 9/11, was how to invade Iraq and how to sell it to the American people. David Bonnier, and so we ought to let that happen rather than jumping to the conclusion that it won't happen, dooming it before it ever happens, and thus laying the pretext or path to war. The emphasis ought to be placed on trying to get this done as opposed to not getting it done. And we don't need pressure by Saddam Hussein or by George Bush or Tony Blair on the process. Let the UN inspectors do their work, and then we'll see what happens. So then Paula Zahn asking implicitly, oh, are you a dupe? Are you an idiot, Mr. Bonnier? She says, Representative Bonnier, do you trust Saddam Hussein? Give me a break. Bonnier, well, of course, Saddam Hussein has committed some very bad atrocities while he's been in public office. We all know that. The question is not whether or not I trust Saddam Hussein. The question is whether I trust impartial observers like Hans Blix from the United Nations to come in and make a good judgment. He says, we need people like Nelson Mandela and other people who have stature in the world community who don't want us to go to war, by the way, to come here and look and see if the process is working. I think with the media, with the UN, and with the kind of that kind of corroboration of what is happening, we will then know the answer to where we're headed in the months ahead. Now, tragically, he didn't know the answer had already been decided by the Bushes. And CNN and all the rest of the media were all, hey, let's go to war. It'll pump up ratings and we'll make more money. We can charge more for our advertising. We'll have more eyeballs. We can come up with fancy graphics for it. America at war. Bombing Iraq. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And Ron was a whiz bang on the dial. Almost as big as Jesus.
Yeah, good old Enron.
They have captured your name. And they put it on a baseball park downtown. Enron took my money. We lost it all that day. With questionable accounting, I gutted my 401k. When the New York Times said the stock is dead, now the trial's begun. They'll be taking the fifth like Kenneth Lee.
Yeah, just like Kenneth Lee, isn't it? I love that song. Ah, the Enron song. Yes. I got hosed by Enron. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. We're revisiting history here for a few moments on this program, and I think the reason why is because whoever it was who said it, what was it, Churchill? I'm not sure. You know, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. That the neocons, the cons in general, are trying as aggressively as they can to rewrite the history of 2002-2003, and they are repeating it right now in front of our faces. Cranking up the war.
cranking. Oh, be afraid, be afraid, be afraid. We need to drop more bombs. We need to get those planes in the air. Back then it was Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, don't you know? And now, well, it's going to be, I think, a fairly safe prediction. Look out for Iran. They're going to have a nuclear weapon in the next 5 years, so we've got to blow them up now, just in time for the election, don't you know? It's important. Got to do that. There's an election coming up. Got to make people afraid. I mean, it is so transparent. And yet it keeps working. Walter Cronkite, the quotes I was sharing with you before from Congressman Jim McDermott and Congressman David Bonnier of Michigan, both of them essentially saying, hey, let's give the weapons inspectors an opportunity to do their job. That's all they were asking. You know, at the same time that Bush is running around saying,
facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
When he already knew there was no possibility of a mushroom cloud and there was no clear evidence of danger, this is just an outright lie. This should be an impeachable offense. That statement should be an impeachable offense. A month later, after September 30th, 2002, when the Paula Zahn did her interview with Bonnier and McDermott, Walter Cronkite spoke out. October 28th, 2002. Christopher Farrell, writing in the Bryan College Station Eagle. He's Walter Cronkite, the veteran newsman who covered almost every major world event that took place during his six-decade career, on Sunday warned that if the United States takes action against Iraq without support from the United Nations, it could set the stage for World War III. Cronkite said, the threat from the White House is to go in anyway. Our only ally would probably be Great Britain. That is not good enough. I see the possibility that if we do that, of a really setting forth World War III. And in fact, we did not go in with the support of the United Nations. UN Resolution 1440 said that hostile action against Iraq could only commence by members of the United Nations Security Council, could only commence if Hans Blix and or Mohammed al-Baradei, the conflicts looking for conventional chemical and biological weapons, and Mohammed al-Baradei looking for nuclear weapons, if either one of those two men came back and said, you know, we have evidence of weapons, or we have evidence that they are concealing something that might be weapons, then hostilities can commence. In other words, then you can go bomb the bejesus out of them. But only then. And they never reached that point. They never had that opportunity to finish. Because George W. Bush pulled them out. He said, you know, we're going to start bombing. So get the heck out of there. And Hans Blix had to come home before he was done. And he was, you know, frankly, a little, shall we say, unhappy about that.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
That was on September 18th, 2002. And say, we don't, or 2003, rather. Say, we never had an opportunity to get that evidence. Cronkite, back to this story by Christopher Farrell. Cronkite, who began anchoring the CBS Evening News in 1962, said, this country, the United States, is at a very critical point in its history. Cronkite said he fears Americans are learning less and less about what their government is doing, and worse, they do not seem to care. That means we don't have a democracy, said Walter Cronkite. We've got an oligarchy here, not a democracy. He set an example. He said, for a country's citizens to be truly free and the government to be held accountable, people must have a free press that gathers all the facts. Cronkite said an example of the alternative would be a situation like he witnessed after World War II, after the Nazi concentration camps were freed. The people who lived in nearby towns cried at the sight of the persecuted Jews and told reporters they had no idea. Yeah. Well, Cronkite says they were as guilty because they bought the propaganda.
He said, give us, when they did not rise up and say, give us a free press, they became just as guilty as the Nazis. This is Cronkite. And here we are. Check out worldcan'twait.net for more. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovered corporate lies, exposed political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Yesterday we had Greg Palast on the program, and he was talking about how the Department of Homeland Security was contemplating, or I believe he said that they had actually charged him with a criminal complaint for taking pictures of the ExxonMobil refinery next to the where FEMA has got 70,000 people in a giant compound in trailers with barbed wire around it with one bus going in and out of it. He was down there filming it, and apparently that's a crime. And so today we just got this email just minutes ago from Greg Palast himself, to me. He says, Tom, Exxon's corporate headquarters Houston called to say they are backing off their complaint. Hopefully this will satisfy Homeland Security, but Exxon, having unleashed the official dogs on us, might not necessarily being able to whistle them back. I'll try to get our freedom confirmed today by the feds. Thanks for your on-air support. It was Exxon's PR chief who called, not the security department. It's clear that it was public embarrassment at their boorish attempts to control their image that led to their backing off. From Greg. So we'll see, you know, we'll see how this goes on, and we'll have Greg back on the program and keep you up to date on this. I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on with the Arctic ice, but I noticed that one of our callers here has apparently been dropping acid, and thought it'd be interesting to have a conversation. Joe in Las Vegas, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joe, you seem to think that Hans Blix left Iraq because Saddam Hussein told him to.
Yeah, how you doing? Actually, it's mushrooms I'm doing, not acid. So.
Oh, okay. All right. You know, it's organic, so it's water.
How many years are we going to have the UN in there doing meaningless inspections?
Well, Hans Blix actually said that he figured another month and he would be done.
Another month?
Yeah, one more month. That's what he, when he went before the United Nations in February of 2003, or in April of 2000, January, February, March, yeah, in February of 2003, he said, give me one more month. And the United States and the United Kingdom sabotaged essentially that.
How long was he in there, though?
I'd have to go back and look. I would guess he had been in there probably about a month and a half, 2 months. It wasn't long.
How long was the UN in there looking, searching, though? The UN had been in there for years.
Yeah, the original UN, originally Scott Ritter went in 1991, right after the Gulf War. And
right.
He was there from 1991 until 1997. And, in fact, Scott told this story on this program. In the process of that period of time, they scoured this country. This is a country the size of California with 40 million people. They scoured that country and found thousands of tons of weapons, gas, you know, all kinds of stuff, and destroyed it. I mean, they weren't just inspecting stuff. They were destroying things. And they were able to document, to actually physically document, that they had destroyed 97% of all of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There was still 3% that they couldn't account for. And their best guess was that was just paperwork, that they had actually gotten everything. But then Scott Ritter wanted to continue. But then there was a half a dozen buildings in Baghdad and outside of Baghdad. And he's told this story on this program and in his book, and, you know, and this is no secret. And in fact, it's part of the official record. There are half a dozen buildings that Hussein wouldn't give him access to. And so he went back to Bill Clinton. He was working for the United Nations, keep in mind, not for Bill Clinton. But he went back to the United Nations, and he also went to Bill Clinton, and he said, you know, they won't give us access to these things. And so at the request of the Clinton administration, Ritter and his investigators were brought out of Iraq, and we, the United States, bombed Iraq. We blew up every single one of the buildings that Scott Ritter said he thought might have something in it that they were hiding. Just blew the hell out of them. Total smithereens. And at that point, that was the end of the weapons inspecting in the 1990s.
Right. How many innocent people were killed when we just bombed the buildings?
Well, that's a good question, and that's something that Scott Ritter is still concerned about.
But that's something that the left doesn't bother with because it's not a Republican administration. The problem I have is
I'm not defending it. I would hope.
Well, no, but you said it so proudly. You said it so proudly that the Clinton administration went in and bombed all these buildings. You were proud to.
Joe, I would much rather have the Clinton administration blow up a half a dozen buildings let me finish my sentence, Joe. And even if it tragically kills some civilians, I would much rather have that happen than have George Bush go in and kill 120,000 civilians who are not involved in the hostilities and have 2,500 of our troops dead and another 30,000 of them losing legs, arms, and eyes.
Right. They were involved in the hostilities, though. They were involved in the food for oil program, which France and Germany undercut. They were selling weapons. There was many of reasons to go in there.
Who's the they that you're talking about?
What's that?
Who's this they that you're talking about?
The people, the innocent people that you said were being that George Bush killed. They were involved in it because they were the ones being tortured. They were the ones.
The 12-year-old kid standing on the street who gets blown up by a bomb during the shock and awe campaign is as culpable as Saddam Hussein.
It's war. I mean, there's tragedies on both sides.
It was not war. It was an illegal invasion. They have not declared war on us. They have not commenced hostility against us, Joe.
But if Bill Clinton did it, it wouldn't be an illegal invasion. It would be something you would proudly say.
Bill Clinton did that bombing with Bill Clinton.
What's that?
Bill Clinton bombed those buildings with the permission of the international community. The United Nations authorized that bombing.
Right, but who had veto?
George W. Bush invaded Iraq without the authorization of the United Nations.
Right. Well, who had that? That's why. It's because France and Germany both had veto power in the UN, and they both were undercutting the world by buying illegal oil from Saddam Hussein and selling weapons.
No, they did. It's got nothing to do with that. You're mixing apples and oranges. They said, we are perfectly willing. France and Germany signed off on 1440. We are perfectly willing to attack Saddam Hussein, to blow up his country and to go in there and invade it. We're perfectly willing to. We just have to have one thing satisfied. Either Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei has to say that there might even possibly be weapons of mass destruction there. And neither one of them ever reached the point where they could
say that.
No, they didn't.
They all said that. Hans Blix, John Kerry even said that.
Joe, I strongly suggest you go back and read Resolution 1441. I mean, you really ought to read the thing.
You know what? You need to go back in history and look and see. My senator, Harry Reid, was the first Democrat to sign on to give George Bush permission to use military action. John Kerry, who ran for president as an anti-war man, said that... gave him permission to go to war, and not only did he do that, he came out before George Bush even said anything about going to war with Iraq, that we should go to war with Iraq because Saddam Hussein's a terrorist. That was John Kerry.
Kerry is now saying that... You're trying to turn this into all or nothing. First of all, if Harry Reid was saying, or if John Kerry was saying, yeah, let's go in there and bomb them before Hans Blix said that, then I would condemn that. But that's not my recollection of it. My recollection of it was that they said...
I have a letter. I'll be happy to fax you.
They said...
That Harry Reid was the first one, and I have audio tape of John Kerry being interviewed on CNN with the man...
Well, let's say for a moment, Joe, that that's the case. They were wrong.
Okay, but then condemn them.
But that
too.
Doesn't make it right.
It doesn't make it right. It doesn't make, but it doesn't, you people want to put the...
You
the,
people?
You people, yeah, I'm not being
I thought
Rachel.
We were all Americans
I'm
here,
not
Joe.
Rachel. Well, what I'm saying is you people on the left, we're all apples here. But don't, I mean, I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything. You people who want to put it all on George Bush, want to only put it on George Bush and not look at John Kerry, not look at Senator Harry Reid, not look at Feinstein, not look at all the other people who were also involved, who had intelligence, who were on the Intelligence Committee. You just want to say George Bush, George Bush. George Bush just can't go in without Harry Reid, without John Kerry, without all these other people involved.
You're right. You're right, Joe.
The only person,
Robert Byrd was the only guy who really stood up. He was the only guy who really stood up. And you know, you're right. And although, again, John Kerry's running around right now saying, well, the reason that I voted for that was because we wanted to give George Bush a stick, hoping he wouldn't have to use it. But nonetheless, yeah, Robert Byrd.
That's what you do. You give someone a stick hoping they don't use it. No, you give a stick to someone who's willing to use it, who's got the balls to go
to try to avoid the death of 100,000 innocent civilians. Yes,
no.
Joe, I'm sorry. I'm not so easily willing to write off the death of human beings as you are.
No, do you know how
I know you think it's real macho and you got real big balls, but I'm telling you, it's pathetic that you're defending the death of innocent civilians for political purposes for George W. Bush, and so that Dick Cheney can make some oil money. It's pathetic, and you know, it's tragic. In fact, what I'd like, I'll share with you Robert Byrd's words on the floor of the Senate on March 19, 2003, the day before Bush declared we were going to war, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I went out in the darkness just searching for some place to be. Wasn't looking for trouble, I guess it was looking for me. And I knew I was wasting my time. But it was nobody's business, nobody's.
Well, yours and Alberto Gonzalez's, now that he's listening in on everything, and Death Squad John Negroponte in charge of the whole thing. 858 days, 11 hours, 37 minutes, 10 seconds until George W. Bush is required by the Constitution to step down, barring impeachment. Welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Resolution 1441 of the United Nations has a whole bunch of articles. You know, there's a series of them. Article, paragraph 4. These are the basis under which Iraq can be attacked. Okay, this is the bottom line. You know, it starts out recalling all its previous relevant resolutions, blah, 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 blah. Recalling also deploring the fact that Iraq has not provided accurate, full, final, complete disclosure, blah, 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 blah. So then it gets to, okay, here's what we can nail them for. If acting under Chapter 7 of the Charter of the United Nations, number 4, if the UN Security Council decides that false statements or omissions in the declaration submitted by Iraq pursuant to this resolution and failure by Iraq at any time to comply with and cooperate fully in the implementation of this resolution, that shall constitute a further material breach of Iraq's obligations and will be reported to the Council for assessment in accordance with paragraphs 11 and 12. Now, paragraph 12 was the one that said, we can go in and kick their butts. What did paragraph 11 say? Paragraph 11 says, directs the executive chairman of UNMIFIC and director general of the IAEA, in other words, Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei, to report immediately to the Council any interference by Iraq with inspection activities, as well as any failure by Iraq to comply with its disarmament obligations, including its obligations regarding inspections under this resolution. Saddam Hussein was in a box. And this, and paragraph 12, decides to convene immediately upon receipt of a report, in accordance with paragraphs 4 or 11 above, in order to consider the situation and the need for full compliance with all of the relevant council resolutions in order to secure international peace and security. Number 13 recalls in that context that the council has repeatedly warned Iraq that it will face serious consequences as a result of its continued violations of its obligations. Number 14 decides to remain seized to the matter. That's it. That's the end of Resolution 1441. In other words, if Blix or El-Baradei say Saddam Hussein won't let us see things, he's toast. And they never said it.
Bush had to go back to the UN and twist arms 6 months after the illegal invasion of Iraq on March 20th, 2003, in order to get the UN to retroactively make legal what Bush had done that was criminal, which was the killing of over 100,000 civilians and the invasion of a country which represented absolutely no threat to the United States. And it's tragic that Republicans have been able to get testosterone-challenged males, by and large, in the United States to think that somehow this was a good thing, that inflaming the world against us was a good thing. Robert Byrd, March 19th, 2003, on the floor of the Senate, the day before Bush makes his announcement, the day before Bush goes out and says to the Iraqi people, we are going to invade your country, and oh, by the way,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And yeah, and at that point they all went, oh man. Well, the day before that, Robert Byrd on the floor of the Senate. Today I weep for my country. I have watched the events of recent months with a heavy, heavy heart. No more is the image of America one of strong yet benevolent peacekeeper. The image of America has changed. Around the globe, our friends mistrust us, our word is disputed, our intentions are questioned. Instead of reasoning with those with whom we disagree, we demand obedience or threaten recrimination. Instead of isolating Saddam Hussein, we seem to have isolated ourselves. We proclaim a new doctrine of preemption, which is understood by few and feared by many. We say that the United States has the right to turn its firepower on any corner of the globe which may be suspect in the war on terrorism. We assert that right without the sanction of any international body. As a result, the world has become a much more dangerous place. We flaunt our superpower status with arrogance. We treat UN Security Council members like ingrates who offend our princely dignity by lifting their heads from the carpet. Valuable alliances are split. After the war has ended, the United States will have to rebuild much more than the country of Iraq. We will have to rebuild America's image around the globe. We cannot convince the world of the necessity of this war for one simple reason. This is a war of choice. There is no credible information to connect Saddam Hussein to 9/11.
We've got no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Yeah. But that was a year and a half after the fact. Saddam Hussein, said Robert Byrd, is the wrong villain, and this is the wrong war. If we attack Saddam Hussein, we will probably drive him from power, but the zeal of our friends to assist our global war on terrorism may have already taken flight. What is happening to this country? When did we become a nation which ignores and berates our friends? When did we decide to risk undermining international order by adopting a radical and doctrinaire approach to using our awesome military might? How can we abandon diplomatic efforts when turmoil in the world cries out for diplomacy? Why can this president not seem to see that America's true power lies not in its will to intimidate, but in its ability to inspire?
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's all good. It's all right. Lord, it's always a good day when you're glad to be alive. Everything I need ain't too hard to find. Why don't waste my time complaining? Cause I don't see how I could.
Welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a wrap-up, Robert Byrd's speech on the floor of the United States Senate, March 19, 2003, the day before Bush announced the invasion of Iraq. The title of his speech, The Arrogance of Power. The last sentence I'd read just before the break, why can this president not seem to see that America's true power lies not in its will to intimidate, but in its ability to inspire? War, Byrd said, appears inevitable. But I continue to hope that the cloud will lift. Perhaps reason will somehow still prevail. I, along with millions of Americans, will pray for the safety of our troops, for the innocent civilians in Iraq, and for the security of our homeland. May God continue to bless the United States of America in the troubled days ahead, and may we somehow recapture the vision which for the present eludes us. And I just have to say, more than anything else, that is the tragedy. George W. Bush, for all of his, you know, whatever, from the day that he was first appointed president by the Supreme Court until today, has reshaped America. And not just George W. Bush, frankly. I mean, this has been right across the board in the Republican Party. They have reshaped America in a way that is fundamentally different than the historic vision of America. And it's I don't know how to say it beyond that. I mean, it's an absolute tragedy what has happened. That the world is looking at us like this. That people are, you know, I would say to Joe in Las Vegas, respectfully, Joe, I doubt that you have ever been in a war zone. Now, I've never been in a war, but I've been in a war zone, and I've seen people shot and killed in and I've held people who are dying of starvation, children, babies who are dying as I don't want to get maudlin, but I've been there. And it is a horrible thing to watch another human being die, particularly when you know that it was not necessary. Jim Jeffords, the Republican senator from Vermont, in a moment of candor with Vermont Public Radio, the Republican senator from Vermont, he's now an independent. This was several years ago, right after the, just after the war.
But does the situation now in Iraq?
The opening question is from the, I don't recall his name, I'm sorry, but from the fellow with Vermont Public Radio.
But does the situation now in Iraq essentially show that he made the right decision?
I don't believe so. I was against it at the beginning, and I'm still against what invading Iraq. I think it's created huge problems. I feel that we should never have gone in there. I think it was all done to get oil. I think that's the end result is going to be some oil agreement, and to the loss of life that we had and to the cost of it was to me just a re-election move, and they're going to try to live off it and probably start another war. Wouldn't be surprised next year. Probably in Iran.
Do you think that's likely?
Oh, I probably shouldn't even talk on it. I just feel so bitter about the thinking that's gone on behind them and the reasons they go to war and went to war. But I feel very strongly that they're looking ahead, and that there'll be an opportunity to go into Iran and try to get their son elected president. I don't know, but they do it each time they want to have a new president. I'm very, very, yes. Oh, well, I better be quiet.
And at that point, Jim Jeffords censored himself and said, you know, we won't talk about that anymore. But what's happened to the days when we had presidents who talked about peace?
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds, and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace.
It's John Kennedy, 1963.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war, not the peace of the grave, or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children, not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women, not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
This is a man who saw and was wounded in war.
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task.
This is from a man whose older brother died in war.
no government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
Yeah, and bombed.
Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility.
Now, this is pre-John Bolton, of course.
For we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute.
See, this is the it's so easy to psychoanalyze this, to say, oh, you know, the Bushies and the guys, the by and large men that they get behind them are all suffering from small penis syndrome or something like that. But there is something fundamentally wrong. And I think it goes way beyond any kind of little psychobabble thing like that. There's something fundamentally wrong with the use of the death of other, the organized mass murder, which is what war is, when it is not absolutely necessary for defensive purposes.
Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished.
And the UN, as I said, did not authorize the attack on Iraq, and in hindsight, they were right and Bush was wrong.
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war.
See, tragically, Jack Kennedy, looking back at the entire 200-year history of the United States at that time, or almost 200 years at that time, believed that to be true. He had no idea that George Bush was coming.
We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
But George W. Bush, he got out. You know, he went to Alabama and got drunk, so he didn't know about
war. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
I mourn the loss of statesmen. Pamela in Ennis, Missouri. Hey, Pamela, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Pamela from Montana.
Oh, Montana, I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, thanks very much for that last recording. Boy, I miss it too. I just wanted to say about Joe in Las Vegas. He either just took those mushrooms and will be calling you later, blubbering and apologizing for having been brainwashed, and that's really not who he is, or he didn't take them.
Yeah.
Because I just really hate marijuana and mushrooms to be given this rep that anybody, that's just not what it's about.
Yeah, because psychedelics generally put you in touch with your humanity. They don't divorce you from it.
Yeah, it makes you, you know, if I was in Las Vegas doing mushrooms, I'd be ripping my clothes off and running out into the desert to keep them from blowing up that big bomb or something.
There you go.
It would not be calling up Tom Hartman and saying, you left-wing blah, 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 blahs.
Yeah.
So I know it's not an important thing, but it does, I just hate people to think that, people go do magic mushrooms and then they go to war.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
Good point, Pamela. Thank you for your spirited defense of mushrooms. Larry in Seattle. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for bringing Senator Byrd to mind, but I want to remind everybody about Senator Patty Murray's 20-minute address to the Senate floor on October back in October the 9th, 2002. She made statements against the threat of Saddam Hussein, but also what the response to the threat should be: disarmament, her opposition to the preemption doctrine, who our allies are.
Yeah. Senator Patty Murray did a marvelous job and needs to be remembered for that. Larry, thank you very much for pointing that out. Appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So that's how it is. That's what we got. And if the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye. Call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the Great High Plains. It's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. The program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Not a chance. 1-866-440-8466, our toll-free telephone number all across the United States of America. John in Mount Vernon, Washington. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, that guy wasn't on mushrooms. He was on a combination of Oxycontin and Viagra. That's what he was on.
We've heard that before, haven't we, on the air?
Yeah, and the thing is, I realize it isn't as simple as talking about how the size of your balls. But the fact is, so many of these guys, I'm that guy who stands on the corner with the George Bush is a fascist sign.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, it's always a guy on a phallic symbol driving up to the red light and threatening my life. And then I stand there. I don't go anywhere. The light turns green, and they go on.
Yeah, okay? Usually roaring off, right?
These guys all think that this whole thing is one big old planetary game of risk.
Yeah.
Okay? It's easy. It doesn't take balls, Tom, to send other people to kill innocent people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay?
His phrase, you know, And
not only that, but going back, I called a little earlier this week and got cut off, and we were talking about conservatives and things, what a conservative is. And to go back to that, what I was talking about, I realize Burke and the definition and all of that, but I'm talking about the people around me who call themselves conservatives.
Yeah.
They are not. Their definition of conservative is not what George Bush and these fascists are.
Yeah.
Okay? They believe in family values. They believe in limited government.
Oh, yeah. No, I understand. My father, you know, was a Republican until the day he died and considered himself a conservative.
One other thing. These guys, you know, when it's as far as George Bush goes, he is a classic case. He isn't. They say that he has big whatevers, but what he was born with a silver spoon in his nose. That's what he was.
Yeah. Okay, John. Thanks. Ann Richards, you know, rest her memory. Ann Richards, who died today. By the way, starting tomorrow, I'll be doing this show live from the Quake in San Francisco. On Monday, this program is going to be picked up by the Quake in San Francisco, I don't have the call letters in front of me, a station in Minneapolis, the Air America radio station in Minneapolis, and by KPOJ in Portland, Oregon. So picking up a few more affiliates as we go along. 1-866-440-8466. Ann in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Ann.
Hi. When listening to Joe, I have to tell you that happens a lot. I've spoken with congressional aides, and they end up with, well, you know, and Clinton did this, or Clinton, he was worse with this, or, you know, Bush did that. The thing is, you know, it's hard to get through to them that they're not getting through to you. You can't get beyond it. If they identify, they want some reassurance that you're not saying the person is all that you want them to be, but just don't vote for the worst. don't vote for somebody. At least the Democrats try, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, when Sharon went to the Temple Mount and Clinton caved, that illustrated for me the failure of Democrats. But the purpose of people like George Bush is pure sabotage. That's his job, to come in, to create cash cows for his friends, to bait and switch, and to sabotage.
Yeah, and to hold as much political power as he can, as long as he can. Well said, Ann. In fact, Jimmy Carter now, another statesman, one of the few presidents that we've had who was an actual statesman, and also, you know, was in the military. Carter never saw combat, but he was in the military and well understood the military. Talking about Joe Lieberman, but, you know, it's specifically about Lieberman, case in point.
With public statements that misled the American people into believing that the Iraqi war was justified, he's joined in with the Republican spokespersons by saying that Democrats who disagree are really supporting terrorism. So for all these reasons, I've lost my confidence in Joe Lieberman and don't wish to see him reelected.
Yeah, well said. Ken in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Ken.
Yeah, hi. I've got a book called Upfront by Bill Malden. He used to draw cartoons during World War II, and one of them just really sticks in my mind during this conversation. Willie and Joe, you know who they are, right?
No.
Oh, well, they were a couple of GIs that were in these cartoons. And
oh, yeah, you're talking in the 40s.
World War II, right.
Yeah.
And they've just come off the line, and they're sitting on the street, and they're tired, and they're scared, and they're watching this new guy who's just come off the boat. New recruit. He's got his fists doubled up. He's got a sneer on his face, and he's strutting around. And Willie says to Joe, "That guy ain't no soldier. He's looking for a fight."
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm wondering, and what is twisting me in my guts, is why is it that these people, these men, these so-called men, who have never been to war, are always the first ones that want to dive into it?
Because it's been glorified in our culture. Because it's been glorified in our movies, because we've had, you know, many of us grew up on movies and television where people get shot and they just fall over quietly, which is not how it usually happens. People tend to thrash around and scream a lot because they don't understand what it is, because George W. Bush decided that he'd rather go to Alabama and work on the political campaign of a friend of his daddy's than even be in the Texas Air National Guard, where he avoided the Vietnam War, because Dick Cheney got a series of deferments, 5 deferments, because Karl Rove had other priorities, because Rush Limbaugh had a pimple on his butt. I mean, that's why. But, you know, rhetorically, good question, Ken. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good, the Tom Hartman radio program. I am going to get to this Arctic ice melting story, because there's a story behind the story that really concerns me. But just to wrap up the conversation that we've been having for the last 2.5 hours here, and then we're going to be hearing from Steve Sinton at 20 minutes past the hour, and then we'll get back to back to the news at the bottom of the hour. Just to wrap this up, a bunch of people on the line here who want to follow up on it, so let's just, you know, follow through with that. And Chris, I'm not seeing what city you're in on the board here, but welcome to the program.
It's I'm in Seattle, Tom.
Oh, okay.
And thanks a lot for doing your show. You have a great program. You really meet your adversaries well, and people who, you know, can't even be in the same I wanted to ask you a question about the UN.
Sure.
Something I bring up from time to time with some of my other conservative friends.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, "Oh, that's not true. We can't do that." Something about how I heard years ago, during the Reagan era, that we stopped paying our union dues, or
yeah,
some type of union dues, because it seemed like they had a problem with how the UN, as part of their mission, devotes a lot of their work to family planning. And a lot of conservatives in the government at the time, and today, as far as I know, has said that they oppose that. And I'd like to see if that's true, and if I can still throw that in the face of some of my friends, I'll take my answer off the air. And again, I really appreciate the work that you do.
Okay, great.
Thanks
a lot. Thanks a lot, Chris, for the call. Here's what I know about that. Ronald Reagan is one of those guys who didn't like the UN. The Republicans in general, I mean, I think I mentioned this briefly yesterday, Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat who fought and won World War I, tried throughout his entire political career to get the United States into the League of Nations, tried to get the League of Nations off the ground. I mean, this was his goal and was unsuccessful. And we never got into the League of Nations. Some would say that, the League of Nations' role with their ability to stop Hitler or not stop Hitler is pretty arguable. I mean, the world learns from experiences. But in any case, we never joined the League of Nations. So we joined the United Nations. The United Nations was formed, and the United States helped form it and joined it in 1945, right after World War II. It was the Republicans who had blocked Woodrow Wilson and who prevented us from getting into the League of the Nations, and the Republicans fought tooth and nail against Harry Truman getting us into the United Nations in 1945. And generally speaking, quote, conservative Republicans, end quote, opposed the United Nations, you know, to this day, just in principle. And the principle that they object to actually, you know, at a certain level has a certain sound of reasonableness to it, and that is that by signing the United Nations Charter and some of the treaties that we signed, that every nation signs, in order to become a member of the United Nations, you essentially surrender, the country surrenders a certain level of sovereignty or a certain level of decision, independent decision-making power, that being principally the power to decide whether or not to declare war on another country preemptively. That's the main, that's 99% of what joining the UN does, is it removes from a country the international legal right to simply declare war on any other country. And you say by treaty, no, we're not going to do that. And this is why I say the world was horrified when George Bush attacked Iraq, and it's why the world is still horrified. So you've got a lot of conservatives who, and by the way, this is my problem with the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and CAFTA, is that we surrender our sovereignty to multinational corporations. I think that's a much worse reason to surrender your sovereignty. Surrendering a little bit of sovereignty, the right to declare unilateral war in exchange for world peace, seems like a reasonable trade-off to me. Surrendering economic sovereignty to multinational corporations, so that multinational corporations can get rich and your middle class can get wiped out and your political class can get more powerful, seems like a bad deal to me. And that's, you know, the World Trade Organization. So, number one. Number two, yes, Reagan stopped paying dues to the United Nations for a while when he was president, and we're still way behind. We are, to this day, behind in making our payments to the United Nations. Ted Turner, that's why Ted Turner went and donated $1 billion to the UN. He said, I'm embarrassed by what the United States is doing. And toss some money into the pot. But Reagan did it in a very slick way. He let the people who were opposed to what the UN is doing with regard to birth control around the world think that that's why he was doing it. He let the people who think that the UN is just a, you know, the Antichrist, you know, this is the one world government that John predicted in the Revelation. He let them think that that's why he was doing it. He let the people who don't want any other country telling us who we can invade and who we can't, let them think that that's why he was doing it. But the bottom line was that, you know, he was a unilateralist. There's also this myth out there. There's a series of myths about the United States. One of the main ones, and by the way, let me just go back to the birth control thing. The United Nations is a democratic institution. All of its members vote. The United States is one of the members. In a way, it's not as democratic as most democracies, in as much as there's this Security Council thing, you know, that can pretty much override the votes of, you know, countries like Zambia or Haiti or Venezuela or whatever. If you're on the Security Council, you've got a lot of power. You have the ability to stop anything. But
at the level that it is democratic. The United Nations is a democratic institution, sort of like the United States government. We may not like everything our government does in our name, but we still pay our taxes. So if you don't like what it's doing, you try and change the institution. You don't simply say, I'm not going to pay my taxes. But that's what Reagan did, and it was tragic. Another myth, the U.S. pays for almost all of the U.N. programs and peacekeeping operations. The reality, the U.S. is supposed to pay 22% of the U.N.'s regular budget and 27% of the peacekeeping operations, pays about 25% of the cost of the international criminal tribunals for Rwanda and former Yugoslavia. That sounds like a lot. It sounds like other countries are getting a free ride. Well, U.N. membership dues, known as assessments, are actually based on each nation's share of the global economy. If a country has 1% of the global economy, they pay 1% of the cost of the UN. A country has 4% of the global economy, they pay 4% of the UN. Our economy represents 34% of the global economy. So we therefore should pay 34% of the UN budget. But we got it written into the UN charter that no country will pay more than 22% of the UN budget, so that's what we pay. So we're getting a good deal. And then another myth. The U.S. spends a large portion of its federal budget on U.N. policies. Actually, the total amount of money that we pay into the U.N. system, this is assuming that we actually made all the payments all the time, is less than 0.25% of the U.S. federal budget. And another myth, that Americans serving in peacekeeping operations are under the command of the United Nations or foreign governments, not true. As Commander-in-Chief, the President never gives up his command authority over American troops, even if they are serving with the United Nations forces. Although the U.S. sometimes allows temporary operational control to be given to the U.N. or a trusted ally. You know, we loan troops to other countries. The President always retains ultimate command authority over our troops. Period. Here's another myth. Too many American soldiers are serving in U.N. peacekeeping operations, and that the U.S. provides most of the military men and women involved in U.N. peacekeeping operations. At this moment, in the United Nations peacekeeping operations, there are 29 military men and women, 29 Americans. Less than 1% of the total of 60,419 soldiers serving in U.N. peacekeeping operations. We have donated 29 people, period. So that, you know, hopefully has, you know, puts to rest many of the myths about the UN. Steve in Kent, Washington. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to your discussion with the gentleman who was saying it was all the Democrats' fault, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that's really irritated me about progressives speaking about the lead up to the war was that nobody has mentioned that for the 2 weeks prior to the vote in the Senate, which, as I recall, was actually to give the president the authority to use power as a last resort.
That's right.
But prior to that, for 2 weeks before that, Ari Fleischer stood in front of the world and said that the president figured that he had the power to do it anyway, and it didn't matter what the Senate said.
You're right.
And
I wish that you would
find that soundbite and play it for us.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, Steve. Thank you. And the other thing that's important to remember is that resolution that Kerry voted for said that the president had to certify in writing before he could attack Iraq that Iraq was involved in 9/11. And the president did certify that in writing. The letter that the president submitted to the Senate when he commenced operations against Iraq said that Iraq was involved in 9/11. And in fact,
we've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No, it was a lie. Another impeachable offense. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now listen, I watched the news last night on TV. Another scandal up there in D.C. Jack Abramoff, Duke Cunningham, Tom DeLay. Well, there's a new one most every other day.
You got Halliburton camped out in the lobby, making handshake deals behind closed doors. You better do something fast about the price of gas, cause I've been paying for mine and for yours. I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends, we're taking our country back one congressional district at a time. Welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Steve Sinton on the line. Steve just won the primary in Georgia for Georgia's 6th district. Congratulations, Steve.
Set records, as a matter of fact, Tom.
Stratospheric
numbers, absolutely.
That's wonderful. SteveSinton.com, the website, spelled just like it sounds, S-I-N-T-O-N. And this includes Roswell, Kennesaw, Alpharetta, Sandy Springs. I used to live in Roswell, and my recollection is that used to be Newt Gingrich's seat.
Newt Gingrich's seat, you have no idea. I am sitting in Newt Gingrich's seat right now. I rented his office. I am in Newt's old office on Roswell and Robinson, and that's the beginning of changes around here, Tom.
That's great. Steve, I hope you had an exorcist in there.
Oh, no, we just put some mirrors and some garlic up on the wall.
There you go. Get some sage and smoke the place, smudge it. First of all, who's your opponent? What are you up against?
My opponent is Tom Price, M.D., a one-term Republican incumbent who is the face of a $9 trillion debt, $3 gasoline, health care that's the most expensive in the world, a war that won't go away, and a doctor that's voted against stem cell research 3 times.
A hypocrite.
He's just the kind of guy we have to retire. I mean, he is the perfect picture of the kind of guy we're going to put out of business to take back the House. And I am just the guy to do it. As you know, I'm a career broadcaster, one of the creators of Air America Radio, and have come back to this neck of the woods, this part of Atlanta where the family has roots for 26 years, to run against this guy because we know the people in this district, even the Republicans. Tom, I go to Republican candidate forums now. I don't go to Democratic ones. I know they're going to vote for me. And I walk into hostile rooms and we tear the roof off the joint. We've hit the tipping point. Everybody wondered when it was going to happen, when the other side was going to wake up. And now when I stand there and I yell $9 trillion debt and I yell about the inequity and the corporate welfare, these people, their faces just go down to their laps. And then I bring them back up and say, we're good people. Nobody here has horns and a tail. Nobody's got 3 sixes on their heads. And we can do something about this. Join me. I get at least a partial standing ovation in a Republican candidate forum. And they walk up to me after it's over, and they stick out their hand, and they say, I have voted Republican for as long as I can remember, but this time I'm going to vote for you.
That's marvelous. We're talking to Steve Sinton, SteveSinton.com, the website. He's running in Georgia's 6th District. If you were looking for a good candidate to help out, check out SteveSinton.com. Steve, you didn't notice that 666 tattooed on George's forehead?
Filters it out down here.
There you go, yeah. It's the issues in your district. You've twice now kind of recited a short list, but is that it? I mean, or are there, what do you see as the issues that are really going to bring people around?
Up here, the economy and jobs. This Congress has made our number one export our jobs. And while this is the 5th wealthiest district in the United States, and there are 10,000 square foot homes with media centers, every one of them's just 3 paychecks away from disaster, just like anybody else, because that's where the economy has gone. And these people are terribly concerned because these are the people who have to train their foreign replacement as part of their severance package. And I would make that illegal. That is as unpatriotic as anything I can think of. That is a major concern. Stem cell is a major concern. We have the capacity for positive mental medical outcomes. Why don't we get them? Why aren't we using 21st century medicine? This guy has opposed it in 3 votes, and he's a doctor. That's what's unbelievable.
The energy policy of the United States, Steve Sinton.
Well, we need a wartime effort for safe, renewable fuels. We put a man on the moon in 1969. Why are we still burning the same stuff that the horseless carriage did? And why are we paying countries that dislike us intensely and are bent on our destruction for $70 a barrel oil?
Yeah, actually, the first horseless carriage, Frederick Diesel, was running on peanut oil.
Yeah, but you're right. Use peanut oil, and you know, how would you like to fill up at a Chinese restaurant?
There you go. There you go.
Wouldn't that be swell? Hey, Tom, I've got to tell you, the easier way to get to my website is changecongressnow.com, because every once in a while the name gets mangled.
Ah.
So it's changecongressnow.com. And I don't know how much time we've got left in the seg, but
about 10 seconds.
I want to remember Ann Richards, because she was as beautiful as they got, and I loved her dearly. And of the great lines she uttered, the best was absolutely, "When I ride my Harley, I don't need a helmet."
Yeah, really? That's interesting. She was, you know, most famous for her, poor George, don't blame him, he was born with a silver foot in his mouth, about Bush Sr.
That was a great line, but yeah. My favorite was still the line about that beehive, because she had the best one in the business.
There you go. Steve Sinton, running for Congress in Georgia's 6th District. And Steve, the website one more time?
ChangeCongressNow.com.
ChangeCongressNow.com. Thanks a lot for being with us, Steve. Good luck.
Talk to you.
Indeed. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice. Truth be told, it's just a pack of lies.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Madison and Jefferson, not some right-wing think tank. This is from USA Today today. Arctic ice continues to melt at record and near-record levels, further evidence that human production of greenhouse gases is changing the planet's climate for the worst, a panel of scientists reported Wednesday. A satellite image Monday revealed that the annual summer melt of polar ice is near its peak and has nearly matched last year's record, said Mark Cerez of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. He says, what we are seeing now is the health of the system is not particularly good. Even more troubling are measurements of the winter perennial ice cover at the North Pole. In 2005 and 2006, the maximum reach of the winter ice was about 6% below average. That's far greater than the long-term decline of less than 2% a decade, the scientists report. A warming climate and melting polar ice could have severe consequences for marine life and coastal populations. Meanwhile, a new study, this from the McClatchy News Service, article by Martin Mercer, a new study reported more strong links between human-caused global warming and rising ocean temperatures, a key factor in the development and growth of hurricanes. The report stopped short of asserting a direct relationship between the so-called greenhouse effect and the increased hurricane intensity of recent years, but some scientists and others said it supported their belief that industrial pollution, vehicle emission, and other human effects on the environment are largely to blame. And finally, this very concerning, this from the Associated Press, Seth Borenstein. Scientists find new global warming time bomb. Global warming gases trapped in the soil are bubbling out of the thawing permafrost in amounts far higher than previously thought and may trigger what researchers warn is a climate time bomb. An October 2003 photo provided by the journal Nature shows methane bubbles trapped in lake ice in Siberia in early autumn. Methane trapped in a special type of permafrost is bubbling up at a rate 5 times faster than originally measured, according to a study in the Thursday issue of the journal Nature. Methane, a greenhouse gas 23 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, is being released from the permafrost at a rate 5 times faster than thought, according to the study published today in the journal Nature. The lead author, Katie Walder of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, says the effects can be huge. It's coming out a lot, and there's a lot more to come out. Scientists worry about a global warming vicious cycle that was not part of their already gloomy climate forecast. Warming already underway thaws permafrost. Soil has been continuously frozen for thousands of years. Thawed permafrost releases methane and carbon dioxide. These gases reach the atmosphere, help trap heat on Earth, and the greenhouse effect. The trapped heat thaws more permafrost, and so on. This is what is referred to as a positive feedback loop. typically in nature and typically, you know, in systems that are homeostatic, that are in balance, you have negative feedback loops, like, you know, the thermostat in your home. When the temperature reaches, as the temperature goes up, you have to turn on the heat in the winter. As the temperature goes up, it reaches a particular point where the thermostat says, oh, okay, we've got enough temperature, and it flips into a negative mode. It turns off the furnace. That's called a negative feedback loop. In other words, if you get enough, you stop. Just imagine, though, if the furnace in your house was set up so that when it reached that particular temperature, instead of turning off the furnace, it turned the furnace on and even to a higher level. It turned up the furnace. That's a positive feedback loop. And generally, I mean, there are a few circumstances in nature where positive feedback loops are extant or desirable, but by and large, not. But that's what we're creating with global warming. And this is a very, very, very spooky study. So, anyhow, we can get back to the war. We can, George Bush, this Weekly Standard, this from Think Progress, Center for American Progress, Weekly Standard editor Fred Barnes appeared on Fox this morning to discuss his recent meeting with President Bush in the Oval Office. The key takeaway for Barnes was that bin Laden doesn't fit with the administration's strategy for combating terrorism. Capturing bin Laden is not a top priority use of American resources. Huh?
Right. So, Fred, you and a few other journalists were in the Oval Office with the president, right? And he says catching Osama bin Laden is not job number one? Well, he said, look, you can send the 100,000 special forces, that's the figure he used, to the mountains of Pakistan and Afghanistan and hunt him down, but he just said that's not a top priority use of American resources. His vision of a war on terror is one that involves intelligence to find out from people, to get tips, to follow them up and break up plots to kill Americans before they occur, as what happened recently in that case of the...
So let me get this right. Last week, Osama bin Laden was the same as Hitler and was mentioned 15 times in this. Well, actually, if we go back, you know, a year ago.
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I'll be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Yeah, so there's that, and then there's, oh, we've got to get him. This is the guy with Battle of Civilizations, Osama, and using Osama bin Laden's name 17 times in a speech. It did bump his ratings up 4 points. His, you know, be afraid, America, be very afraid. This guy here, a boogeyman is out there. See, you can't, Bush, Rove, really, I'm not sure that Bush understands this, but Karl Rove understands that Superman would be the most boring comic book in the world if it wasn't for Lex Luthor. That Batman would be incredibly boring if it wasn't for the Juggler and the Penguin and the Iceman. You have to have a super villain in order to have a superhero. A superhero can only be as good as the villain. This is the first lesson that they teach aspiring novelists, is the goodness of your good guy will be defined by the badness of your antagonist, the badness of your bad guy. That's what will define how good your good guy is. And so in order for George Bush to portray himself to the American people as a really, really, really good guy, he's got to portray Osama bin Laden, this guy who had 5,000 followers back on 9/11 and only has about 25,000 now, according to the CIA, as some sort of something equal to the Soviet Union with 10,000 nuclear weapons. I mean, he's got to make him into Lex Luthor. And then we get this just cognitive dissonance. You know, wow, wait a minute. Lex Luthor, he's not Lex Luthor. He is Lex Luthor. He's not Lex Luthor. We should get him. We shouldn't get him. I don't know. Mike in Santa Cruz. Hey, Mike, you think I said something wrong. What's that?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I'm glad I finally got through. Early in the, like this is over an hour ago when that guy called in you said was on acid or something?
No, I asked him. He said he was on mushrooms.
Mushrooms, okay. Well, I have another politically correct rant here. I'm concerned about, and I think that I have a cure for world violence. And one of the things I think that we have a problem with on the left is we have a tendency to make you know, reference to small penis syndrome and testosterone-soaked men.
Well, I made that reference because the guy that I was talking to, Mike, had said that Clinton didn't have the balls to do what Bush did.
I know, but the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, I heard yesterday on the air, they talked about violence that happened in Iraq, and they said there were, like, two policemen killed. Later on, they said there was one woman killed. I never hear on the radio that there were, like, so many people killed, including seven men. And the concern that I have is that men are automatically assumed to be violent. They're assumed to be cannon fodder. It's okay to denigrate men. And I think that the reason why we have on the left haven't brought working-class men into the fold to the degree that we should is because we denigrate them. And men, it's very pervasive, and we don't notice it. And I think until we recognize that, you know, blacks, that a lot of times, you know, young black men, their whole life, they get denigrated. And it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. And you have a lot of violence, you know, a lot of blacks commit violent acts.
Yeah.
I think
that... I understand what you're... First of all, Mike, boy, it's just a bunch of different thoughts here. Number one, the fact of the matter is that most violent crimes are committed by men.
Why is that, though? Is it because of testosterone? I think testosterone...
No, it's because of testosterone. It's certainly because of testosterone.
It's as important as estrogen, and in the right level, in the right balance. It's a Zen thing. It's maybe a Kabbalistic thing.
No.
It's a balance.
No, you can see this in the animal world as well. You take an animal and you neuter it, and its behavior changes. And what you're doing when you neuter an animal is different than, you know, a man getting his vas tied, you know, having a vasectomy. When you neuter an animal, you actually remove the testicles, so there's no more testosterone, and all of a sudden they're docile.
Evil? You think that if we were to get rid of testosterone, that would solve all the world's problems?
I think if we were to get rid of testosterone, and, which I would not advocate, by the way.
You know, dignified use.
I think that there would be a lot less violence in the world. I'm not sure that would be, you know, the secondary consequences of it might not be a good thing. I mean, there might be a lot less invention in the world.
I got to tell you, when you channel testosterone in a bad way, you get violence. This is if you were to channel estrogen in the wrong way. And that's the problem.
Well,
what's wrong with the actual thing? It's how you use it, and we don't have an outlet for men's, you know, working class men are angry about something, and they tend to go to Rush Limbaugh rather than to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you there, and the fact of the matter is that Rush Limbaugh, you know, with his Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox, remember that little thing that he rolled out? I mean, is basically saying to them, look out, they're trying to castrate you. I mean, he's using all that sexist language, and really what's happening is middle-class men are being ripped off economically, and that's making them feel insecure. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail?
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Gee, maybe if we're going to do a test, some kind of an experiment on what happens when you strip testosterone out of a whole bunch of men, we should start with any chicken hawks. Anybody who has never been in a war and says we should go to war, that's a good starting point. No, I'm not anti-man. I do, however, think that the Iroquois Confederacy were onto something. The Iroquois Confederacy, which... Ben Franklin stood up at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 in Philadelphia, in the Union Hall there, now known as Constitution Hall, and said, and there were 34 delegates of the Iroquois Confederacy who were sleeping on the second floor of the building and were there as guests of the assembled delegates. And in welcoming them, he said to everybody else in the room, and this was not meant in a derogatory way, he, you know, it was meant
actually as a salutation. He said, if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a union that has survived in peace for over 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same. Well, the thing that the Iroquois had was they had a system of checks and balances. They had basically a legislative set. In many ways, we patterned our Constitution after them, and they had a Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in five of the six Iroquois nations, the Supreme Court, the only people allowed to participate on the Supreme Court, to be the final arbiters of decisions made, were women. And the reason why was because the Iroquois Constitution, the great law, said that all decisions made had to be made in the context of their impact on the seventh generation. Can you imagine how different things would be if corporate boardrooms had to make decisions based on how is this going to affect people seven generations from now? Or how different government would be if every decision made by government had to be made in the context of how is this going to affect seven generations from now? And they knew that the women were more directly and connected with that, while the men were more into, you know, going out and, you know, picking fights and showing off. And it's, I mean, look at nature. Look at peacocks. Laura in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Laura, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom Hartman. I just wanted to let you know that that speech that you took, that you had on it, or the portion of that you did from John Kennedy, which I thought was incredibly wonderful, it really touched my heart because I've been so troubled by the Bush administration and the way they're leading this country. It just saddens me deeply, and it just really touched me, and I think it's something that really needs to keep being broadcast so that, you know, just everybody and maybe the powers that be will actually start at least somehow maybe thinking that, you know, their line of thinking is wrong, and maybe somebody will start thinking about something different.
Yeah, the peace is a good idea. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Laura. That's a speech that I try to play at least every 6 months. And here's just because you brought it up, let me give you a treat here. Here's another. This is John Kennedy right after he was nominated for president by the Liberal Party of New York, speaking at their convention.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
Jack Kennedy, and he's saying that as he's running for office for president. That was a speech from 1960. Welcome back. Let's see here. Peter in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was just curious if you had heard about Greg Palast being arrested there.
Yeah, we interviewed him on the program yesterday, and he talked about the fact that because of a complaint by Exxon, they were filing criminal charges against him. And then earlier in the program, I shared a letter that I got, an email that I got from Greg about 3 hours ago. He says, Tom, Exxon's corporate headquarters in Houston called to say that they're backing off on their complaint. Hopefully this will satisfy Homeland Security, but Exxon having unleashed the official dogs on us, not necessarily be able to whistle them back. I'll try to get our freedom confirmed today by the feds. So he says, thanks for your on-air support. It was Exxon's PR chief who called, not their security department. It's clear that it was publicly embarrassing that their boorish attempts to control their image that led to their backing off. So
that's good, because it could be potentially very scary for all of us that are out there being activists that are trying to expose
their lives to this
administration.
If they back off on Greg Palast, that's a good thing. That's the good news. The bad news is that they're backing off on Greg Palast because he got on national radio and he told his story, and they were embarrassed by it. But there's also still the laws in place, the Patriot Act laws, that say that if you take the wrong picture of the wrong place, you can go to prison. And if you're not Greg Palast, if you're not a New York Times best-selling author, or the friend of somebody who's got a talk show on, you know, on national radio, then you might just vanish into the hole. You might be one of the disappeared. I mean, right now, the Bush administration will not acknowledge whether or not there are vanished people like Jose Padilla who have simply been just, boom, out of sight. Tomorrow, I'll be live from the quake in San Francisco. Congressman Bernie Sanders will be here, and Myron Ebell trying to tell us why Schwarzenegger's signing legislation to cut greenhouse gases is a bad thing. Yeah, that and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.